Welcome to the International Inequalities Seminar Series. Today, my name is Nora. I am a research officer at IAI, and today we are going to hear Luna talking. But before Luna starts, let me quickly announce three upcoming events that are organized or co-organized by the IAI. The next one is next Wednesday, the seminar series on migration, ethnicity, and race. And Amin Ishkanian is going to talk about who needs experts, the politics and practices of solidarity and volunteer humanitarianism in Greece. So this is going to be on February 12th. Then we have a public event, which is a ticketed event, so you need to check the LSE website in order to get tickets in advance. The Shape of the Beast with Arundhati Roy, Amartya Sen, and she is going to present or read some essays. And so you need to get tickets if you want to attend it. And then we have, it's next week Friday. Yeah, on Valentine's Day, yeah. Then we have another inequality seminar series on Tuesday, 18th of February, with Patrick McGovern, Sandra Abradovich, and Martin Bauer on The Dog That Didn't Bark, Income Inequality and the Absence of a Tawny Moment in the Mass Media. So remember to get tickets for The Shape of the Beast, and all others are just free to attend. Today we're going to hear Luna Glucksberg talking. Luna is an urban anthropologist who has worked extensively on elites and how they reproduce, on the role of women and family offices in the reproduction of dynastic families, and how philanthropy can be used by elites to strengthen their own family dynamics. She's currently leading an international project that aims at challenging the rise of wealth inequality by collecting and examining examples of communities that have actually persisted or resisted rising wealth inequality. Prior to joining LSE, Luna gained degrees from UCL and her PhD from Goldsmiths University. She worked at the Center for Urban and Community Research as a research associate, and she also sits on the advisory board for Transparency International UK. Without further ado.
Thank you, Nora, for the wonderful introduction. Thank you to the IAI for inviting me. I'm very excited to present findings from work I conducted a few years back now, and was my very first project here at the IAI. So I will start, as anthropologists often do, with an anecdote, a vignette. And here it is, in quotes, "Piketty is wrong. It's not the same families at the top." And this is how a senior executive at a family office, I will explain what they are in a minute, that I was interviewing, explained his take on the current rise of inequality. His concern, the main point of his job, was to keep his family, his employers actually, he wasn't a family member, from failing, i.e. not managing to transition properly. He showed me this picture. I have better ones later on, but I kept this one because this is how he opened the book and explained to me, this is what happens, this is how it works. So these are here, first, second, third, and fourth generation, and this is, apparently, their decline. And so his job was to stop them from disappearing as an elite family, slipping down the very steep curve of inequality. That was the slipperiness that worried him. That was his main concern. And given his knowledge of the elite sector and how easy it was, in his opinion, for families not to stay at the top. What was interesting was how radically different his reading of Piketty's work and the state of inequality in the world, more broadly, was. And so what I'm doing, so how could someone who is intelligent, educated, informed, and highly knowledgeable in his field, family offices do not hire from the bottom, be so wrong? Or was he starting off from a different set of premises? And if so, what were they? So in a standard trope that is familiar to any social scientist, I would try to understand why someone might behave in a way that might seem irrational to an outsider, only to discover that within the logical framework of the actor in question, their behavior is perfectly rational. So with this presentation, I will try to unpack and explain that statement about Piketty being wrong. And in order to do that, I will explore the worldviews of wealthy families, elites or ultra high net worth individuals, and the staff they employ to help them manage and protect their assets, usually, but not always, employed in family offices. So in order to understand this contradiction, I will use the concept of time, the importance of the temporal dimension for elite families. Now, what does it mean to include the concept of time in thinking about wealth and capital accumulation when Piketty has, of course, already done this? And one of the main points of capital is to look at the accumulation of capital and wealth over time. Well, what I'll do is consider time from the point of view of the individual families and family offices. So what we end up focusing on is the persistency of dynastic families over different generations and what it takes to achieve that degree of continuity and what jeopardizes it, causing anxiety. Why does it matter? Does it matter beyond an academic engagement with a section of society which, as we know, has not so far received the same amount of scrutiny that other sections have? I'd argue it does, for the simple reason that if we agree, and if you're in this room you probably do, that the rise of inequality is something to be concerned about and that it is driven from the top, it becomes imperative to understand how these families think and see the world if we have any hope of engaging with them in a meaningful matter, by which I mean a very robust engagement, hopefully, with the tax authorities. I'm not a lawyer or an accountant, we have, or an economist. I'm an anthropologist, but it seems to me essential that we understand how they think and do, and why they act as they do, and what motivates them, if we have any hope, if we are to have any hope to bring about such an engagement. So, the plan for today is, want to spend a lot of time on this one, because I'd assume in this room we're all very familiar, but just to reiterate that this is the reality of the elite or the top 1% capturing 27% of total growth in 2017, I believe, here. So the fear of falling and if we look in this graph, for example, it's not to scale. This is just so we can see what's going on. But this is 90% and this is 100. So these are 1, 2, 3, 4 squares to show this sort of steep curve here. This is the slipperiness, and the churn refers to the fact that at the top, up there, it is very steep. Or if you don't mess up with the scaling, that is what you end up with. So it is. They are right that it is very steep. And also, just because I understand that I'm talking here about incomes, was what they refer to here, however questionable this graph might be, are assets and wealth as opposed to income. But what we know, we might not know much about wealth as such, but we certainly seem, I think it's an agreed fact that wealth seems to be much more heavily concentrated at the top and much more unequally distributed. So even if the other graphs are about income, we could at least imagine and reasonably assume that it's probably worse for wealth. So, what we're doing today, we've introduced our little paradox, why is Piketty wrong? We'll contextualize it, talk a little bit about the methodology and what I've done in this research, explain what family offices are, what they do, and who they serve. And then we get to the interesting bit, which is generational algebra and what believe it or not, they call the third generation cars. And then we'll conclude. Now, in the late 80s, apologies for pronunciation, Ehrenreich, I believe, wrote about the middle classes and their fears of falling and failing. In 2017, Arseth has recently revived and updated this idea, but applied it to the professional upper classes of Norway. And her work brings much needed nuance to the idea of positional anxiety and shows how two different kinds of parents from either a more professional or established financial elite background act on their anxieties in different ways, with the main variable usually being the ultimate source of their wealth and the likely outcomes for their children. And she shows how parents whose own background is less secure and who had experienced themselves high levels of social mobility were more anxious and therefore engage in more intense forms and stricter forms of parenting practices, as opposed to the more relaxed parenting of those who felt or knew that they truly belonged in their space, in their class, and had time instead to think about their inner happiness, their self-realization through work, etc. Now, this approach resonates with a body of work that I missed a line out of that, huge apologies, that Reeves, Freeman, and Lorison have developed, some of it here at the LSE, showing that the outcome of those here in the UK who have experienced high levels of social mobility in their lives are different and less positive from the ones of those whose parents were already, for example, established in elite professions. And I'm referring here to sample. Now, Hecht deploys a concept of relative disadvantage to explain how financial executives, who by all accounts earn very, very good salaries, they themselves admit so, they feel disadvantaged compared to those above them in the income curve, who sit above them in the income curve, not to mention the wealth curve. They might earn whatever it is that they earn in the city, but they do not have an estate in the countryside. Similarly, Kuzela describes how to become elites in their own rights. Younger generations of Finnish elites need to be socialized into it, need to be taught to become proud of their wealth instead of carrying it around like a burden or a source of shame. Similarly again, Sherman in New York showing how high-powered couples struggle not only to maintain the positionality but to portray themselves as deserving of it. So there seemed to be an understanding of these kind of anxieties that elites are feeling, and they're not surprising. It could well be that we're only relatively speaking discovering them now because elites have become subject of study only relatively recently. Possibly from around 2008, if we like, when Savage and Williams sort of revived the field. Or one could argue that as inequality grows and the stakes become higher and higher, and as the gradient of inequality grows and the price to pay for a fall increases exponentially, so referring here to that right tail of the curve, of how steep it becomes, the elites are starting to feel similar pressures to what the middle classes have always felt because of the nature of their position in the middle. So maybe it's something to do with how vertiginous the landscape of inequality is becoming. However, the fears that my respondents reported were of a slightly different variety. So their main concern was not for themselves, but for their children and increasingly their grandchildren. In other words, time was a key variable in how they thought of and understood risk. They were projected into the future, trying to maintain the dynasty through the generations. Now, just briefly, the project that this work was based on was qualitative in nature. I had 19 respondents, not that many, you could argue, but they are not particularly easy to speak to. So it took quite a lot of work even to get that many to talk. The families themselves were both UK and international, but they either lived or had an office in London, so they had some connection. As I said, there were interviews. I managed to do a little bit of observations at conferences and events, but that was limited. 12 of my respondents were in family offices, and 7 were in consulting or advising firms to family offices. Why would they need consulting and advising if, let's take an example, they might have, and they will have, obviously their own legal teams, but there might be specific questions to do with legislations that might change very quickly, for which they will seek advice from the outside. For instance, if you are sailing a yacht through a number of jurisdictions and there are different legal questions about what might happen if you have drugs on board or all sorts of behaviours on board as you're going through, you would go somewhere else to seek advice. Or rather, your family office would seek advice. 5 of them were in single family offices and 7 in multi-family offices. The difference is relevant. I mean, the terminology is self-explanatory. The single ones only serve one family and the multi serve a few. But what's important for the single ones is that since they invest their own individual family money, for now, they sit outside the Financial Conduct Authority regulation. So they are even more opaque than you think. The multifamily offices, because they're investing other people's money, are subject to FCA regulation. 5 of the members were not the same ones that were in the single ones, but were family members themselves. 8 men and 11 women. The sample was overwhelmingly white, which is really not surprising given the kind of space that world, especially the service providers and the family offices were. I wasn't, again, surprised to find that my only black respondent and Indian African respondent, that was how they, I'll explain later why details are a bit limited here. They were family members themselves, as in they had not been hired into that space. It was their wealth. And that sits with my previous findings of that space being overwhelmingly white. They were all in senior leadership roles, apart from 2 of the women who could be construed as middle management as opposed to chief executives or kind of C-suite people. And here is the rub. All of them were interviewed with consent, so I was ethically sound, but I wasn't able to make recordings of any of the interviews. Hence why, for an anthropologist, I am pretty short on quotes. I don't have any direct quotes. And even more annoyingly, I can't really describe people too closely because their world is quite tight and there are many families that are over 5 or over 6 or over 7 generations. And so if you identify that, you're already compromising their anonymity. So apologies for vagueness.
Yes. Sorry, just a clarificatory question. Could you explain what is a family office? Is it a legal entity that wealthy or elite families go to for advice? Is it...
Yes. I'll get to it in more detail.
Okay.
In fact, hang on.
Yeah.
There.
So
this is one of the many kind of figures that you can find online. Broadly speaking, if you like, a family office can be, there are spectrums or continuums. There can be one man bands, if you like, so one person that runs and helps a family, or it could be at least tens, if not hundreds of people in different locations around the world working on different branches of the family and different generations. So it's a continuum. They can have any, all, or some of these functions in-house. So they might help with strategy, financial planning, advisory, governance. You would have lawyers in there, you would have wealth managers in there, you would have often psychologists, educational psychologists, the kind of people who help with, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it's a good question. One way of thinking of it is that there's the money side, which in a way is more straightforward, and then there's the family side, which is actually harder. It might be softer, but it's harder. And to give you an example or a way of thinking about it, let's say, imagine about a month ago, Christmas dinner with all your family members there. And think for a second that you're not done at 5 or 6 p.m. and you all go back to your lives. You are managing your financial future with them forever. And you have to agree investment strategies, you have to agree asset allocations, you have to agree all of these things and work together. So you might see why you need professionals to help you deal with that and maintain it in such a way that it's harmonious. Now, one way that is crucial for family offices to maintain their elite status over time, as was explained to me, but just to give you an idea of the sort of the scale of the issue, according to, and here I apologize in advance, these are data that are provided by the wealth management sector itself. So they are proprietary data, they don't particularly share how they get them, and they differ from one another, although you also find that they seem to copy from one another quite a bit. If you try and find the source for something, you keep going back. So anyway, they're not, I like to think of them as data that are anthropological data. They show how they think of themselves. So according to Capgemini's 2018 World Wealth Report, combined wealth of high net worth individuals, which are the ones that are plus 10 million, I believe, but they keep changing these categories. The ones that they are really interested in are the ultra high net worth individuals, meaning that they have at least 30 million, the Credit Suisse now calls it 50 million of US dollars in investable assets. So their wealth grew by 10.6% in 2017, surpassing $70 trillion. From a different perspective, which with data that are a bit more reliable, Zucman, Fagan, and Piketty in 2015, using global tax data, estimate that around 8% of global financial assets of households, or 7.6 US trillion, are hidden in tax havens. And that, according to them, has grown by 25% over the last 5 years. On an aggregate level, and I think I have it, it's been estimated that up to 58.1 trillion US dollars of private wealth will be transferred and divided amongst heirs, charities, estates, foundations through the next generation in the US alone, 58.1 trillion. So the scale of the issue is not in question. Because of their nature, it's really hard to tell even how many there are. The single ones don't have to register. A journalist and sometimes colleague of mine estimates, and will not say where he got this one from, he thinks that the number of single family offices in the UK has more than doubled to around 1,000 since the 2008 financial crash, and that they manage more than £700 billion in assets. centered in London. I don't dispute that they're centered in London, but I would take the figures with a pinch of salt. Now, what you have here, and again, these are from their own sources. So the top one is Capgemini, the bottom one is UBS and Camden Wealth. This one is quite interesting because it shows, according to them, when family offices were formed. So the jump is from the 90s to the 2000, apparently. Again, according to their own data. So they go from, well, there's 33% of the ones in existence, meaning the 350 who responded to their survey that were formed in the 2000 and 35 after 2010. And again, you see here how many generations they serve. Usually, the great majority of them, of course, these do not add up to 100, are first, second, and third generation. There's a definite gap here in the ones who last beyond the third generation. In terms of broadly speaking, again, according to them, on average, a family with a family office would have 1.2 billion in their own wealth here. And the office would have, on average, 970 million in asset under management. So that's kind of the sort of figures. In order to be in this game, in order to have a family office, you need to have very substantial amounts of wealth, otherwise it's pointless. Which goes back to how would you support all these professionals that work in-house for you only. So I think we've covered this to give you a sense of, broadly speaking, what they do, which was here, and how they help with tax, they can help with investment, management service, philanthropy, life management, and budgeting, which might seem a strange thing to think about, but if you have never had to budget, because the office, one of the functions that a normal office would do is to take care all together of any kind of bills, of any kind of, you know, your utilities, your water, your gas. It wouldn't be something that you deal with. So if you want to learn, somebody can teach you life management and budgeting. So. Oh yes, and this was the one I was referring to in terms of the ones that they're interested in, which are the ones at the very least with at least 50 million of investable assets. But as we've seen, they're interested in others. And this is one of the definitions. So the ultra high net worth, I don't know if you can see it, would be in the wealthier of the 30 million plus. And then WealthX has invented a new one, which is the very high net worth. I never heard of it before, which is between 5 and 30. They keep jiggling these things, and they keep producing these reports. If you Google them, they're everywhere, trying to sort of say we have the best data. Incidentally, this then generates expectations of us as academics. I sometimes get asked strange things, to produce strange things about wealth, and when I say, well, we don't have this data, they react a little bit surprised, because I say, well, but they do. And I have asked for advice from colleagues here that know better than me, and have confirmed that no, this kind of data does not seem to actually exists from academic perspective, but they seem to think that they know how many, down to the number of adults in the world who own more than 50 million in assets. Now, if you remember, what we were trying to work out was how these families stick around over time. They seem to be quite concerned about this. One example that I can give, is that one practice that somebody described is the importance to keep their assets together, to manage them together and not split them, because otherwise you reduce the rate of return and eventually lead to the decline of the family. So one practice, arguably the most successful but also Okay, but also very frowned upon is primogeniture. It's what the aristocracy does. So only one person can be the firstborn son, but doesn't have to be. But anyway, only one person inherits the capital. Everyone else in the family will be taken care of, there will be trusts, there will be things set up, they're not left out to dry, but the capital remains. And again here, this is where they think family offices are, mainly in the US, some in Europe, and a few around the world. And these are the kind of things that, for instance, Coutts, just down the road, produce. Breaking the world taboo. I think I'm making it up. It's not true. It's that. Look. Making succession a success. This is what scares them. Really does. So you have the steps. Consider your wealth preservations. Allow the next generation to practice. Give them some money. See what they do with it. Truly, that is, I mean, I didn't want to put too many of these fancy images there, but it does say, give them £10,000 to invest, do a little competition between the children, and see who comes back with the most. So they learn how to present to a board, family, but it's the same thing, you're socialising them into this thing. Put fairness into your context, should all the children get the same? What if one is, you know, a social worker, and another one is out in the city making money, should they inherit the same? How do you compensate? And these are all things that are important for the soft bit of the family, because if you don't manage them correctly, down the generations, the resentments will fester and they will split. Or, worse of all, it does say here, I think they're being polite. Oh, yes. What complicates matters? Divorces and stepchildren. 2.5 million of them complicating matters. It's an interesting way of putting it, but I didn't do it. That's their graph. And one in three families dealing with succession suffer conflict. So, yeah, it's a real thing. How long have I got?
10 more minutes.
Wow, okay, so these are the problems. Succession is a problem. And we're skipping here to generational algebra, which, believe it or not, is how it was explained to me. And it exists in their own document. Now, the problem here, if you were to sum it up, is that they believe that the family grows faster than the money. So if you have your first generation and it has this amount of wealth, has three children, each one of them has already got only one third. Interestingly enough, there's no taxation or inflation here. Even I, as a non-specialist, can tell that you're not supposed to simply divide it by the numbers, but that might tell us something in and of itself about how they think of this. So you see that you have a problem. There's too many of them, and by the end, you might only have 12 million. That is bad. That is supposed to be, you know, you've lost it. Plus, there's the third generation curse. Or, so-called, the rule of 92, stating that 92% of a family's wealth is lost by the third generation, because families tend to focus only on the hard needs at the expense of recognizing the importance of soft needs. Or, as another consultant put it to me, you can't just prepare the money for the children, you have to prepare the children for the money. That's the kind of things that we are worrying about. Now, this narrative, employed by both families and family offices, argues that the failure to transition has to do with soft issues that are family related. It's humans that fail, obviously not them, the asset managers. So to do with families that imploded, divorced, split up, could not work together anymore. But as you've seen in the Coutts thing, this is the issue that worries families most of all. This is where their energies are focused. This is what they're trying to avoid. management consultants, in this case PwC, tells them that despite the extraordinary longevity of some individual family firms, the average lifespan across the sector is 3 generations. This is what is repeated again and again and again. It's 3 generations only. And this is why families use family offices to manage their assets and set up trust, succession plans, foundations, offshore vehicles of ever-increasing complexity. Now, we know from economists and economic historians, such as Cummins, not here, but one of an academic associated with the Institute, that this is not true. This is not, in fact, correct. Wealthy families do tend to be able to hold on to their wealth pretty well. I think that. So that's a quote from them. You can read it yourself, but I do small samples. They have done large samples and track people with rare surnames. And it seems to be that there is still a significant correlation between the wealth of families 5 generations apart. So we certainly have a paradox in how they think and what kind of fears are stoked in them and reality. Now, if we come here, if you put these things together, what's fed to them about the third generational curse and this business of a capital staying the same and the family growing faster than the money, you can start to understand why this narrative that tells them that their wealth is growing and the wealthier are getting wealthier and they're dragging inequality up doesn't seem to resonate much with them. His U-curve, Piketty's curve, refers to aggregate data instead of individual families and speaks to a stability and persistence in wealth which the elites fear from an individualized perspective not to be true. These fears are stoked, as we've seen, by their advisors. And this perspective, to me at least, explains this paradox posed at the very beginning of families that are already hugely wealthy, but yet also hugely concerned with their own fall and impoverishment, these are the terms that they use, in the future. But I would argue there's another side. Their anxiety about maintaining and reproducing their position as elite families and fears of losing it drives accumulative behaviors, but it's cloaked in a language that doesn't make it about themselves, but mobilizes the concept of family. By identifying as inheritors or descendants, they frame themselves as part of a larger entity than their individual self, i.e. the family, or more appropriately, the dynasty, which is family and capital together. That's their identity. Now, allowing and enabling the dynasty to continue constitutes their main concern, which they frame, and have a lot of means to do so, as altruistic, a sacrifice they make for the family, instead of an individual pursuit of more and more riches. I don't know if you have seen it, but you might have seen different versions of this. Do you remember the advert for the Patek?
Patek Philippe.
Mm. Yeah. What does it say? You never really own it. Mm-hmm. You're only keeping it for the next generation. Now, the anxiety about losing the wealth and position drives their strategies. But the fact that it's framed in these ways justifies the structures that the families put in place, assisted by their advisors, who create this trust and foundation in as many iterations and combinations one can imagine to allow the wealth to be consolidated and passed down the generations instead of being redistributed through taxation, which, as you have seen here, they don't even have the decency to acknowledge. It is through these narratives, I would argue, of slipperiness and instability that elites can take their inordinate wealth somehow off the table, or try to, in order to portray themselves as ordinary families, simply taking care of their children and grandchildren. Thank you.
Thank you, Luna. Everything's fine with that. The floor is open for questions. Suzanne, what's that?
Thanks, Luna, for the absolutely fascinating talk. Really interesting to hear. Just got some comments and had a question. I'm just with the point you ended, I'm wondering, you know, you're saying that they're framing it like that, that they're doing something for their family, always doing something for their communities, kind of that kind of discourse. And I wonder whether they are actually socialized into this discourse. So if, you know, the parents have already brought them up to become like that. So it's almost an internalized discourse and, you know, so that's one thing. And the other one, you said that there's a paradox between reality of preservation of wealth over five or more generations and the paradox of them feeling like, oh, in three generations it's all going to be gone. But I wonder whether that's actually a paradox or whether the fact that the wealth doesn't actually disappear, whether the paranoia of losing it maintains the wealth because that's why they engage the family offices. So in some ways it's not a paradox, one leads to the other. And my question is about access. How did you find the people? I'm sure lots of us wonder about that. I'm sure you get that question every time, but yeah.
Do I do it in one or
however you want
it? Okay, thank you. So, internalized family discourse, yes, absolutely. This paper, which is why it's taken so long to come out, and it's not out yet, I clearly tried to put too much stuff in one, and I've now realized it's two papers. In the other side, I talk exactly about that, about how those values are socialized in the children, and the family offices are crucial, and philanthropy is crucial in doing that. And I certainly wouldn't, it's a difficult one, because it's really hard to hold in your head these very different, real things. But then we know that humans do that all the time. The third generation curse, maybe it doesn't happen because they are working so hard for it not to happen. I don't know if there are any economic historians here. They might be better placed to respond. Whenever I've put this in front of economists, they kind of laughed at the graphs about the decline, and it doesn't seem very tenable. But Maybe. They're certainly pumped with this story, and it's not, I think, irrelevant to at least reflect on the fact that it's the wealth management industry who stands to gain a lot of money from them that pushes this story most of all.
Andy.
Yeah.
And the access question.
Oh, the access question, yes. Oh, gosh, that's a long story. I had done lots of work around wealthy areas of London, and especially Mayfair, for 2.5 years before doing this project. And I had met people and, to an extent, gained their trust. Also, as it's often the case, and I only realized later, certain actors within the industry wanted certain things, and they were willing to grant access for what they thought would be different kinds of data and because of something that another academic had done before. I think to an extent it was a little bit where they thought I was going to do damage limitation. Mm-hmm. Didn't turn out quite that way. But I think there was an opening that was quite happenstance, if you like. I also think, as always, that the fact that me not being British and not being easily pigeonholed into a certain class or category of people really helps. And being an anthropologist helps. Sociologists are not perceived in the same way. There's still an exoticism about an anthropologist that, although I've only ever done urban anthropology, that somehow helps.
Yeah, thanks, Lena. I'm really fascinated by this kind of long-term dynastic perspective. And I wondered what, if anything, your participants had to say to sort of articulate why they cared or why they should care about the fourth, fifth generations. I can sort of intuitively more understand this concern for your own children and maybe your own grandchildren who will, after all, exist while you're alive. I find it harder to understand what the justification would be for really caring strongly about these people who will never exist during your own lifetime. There's obviously a much bigger kind of philosophical body of work about what we owe to future generations and things, but none of that speaks about what we owe to our future own descendants. That's more
dynasty.
The population at large. So
okay.
I'd be really interested if any of them actually tried to articulate what it was that was driving that.
Thank you. Yes, they do. And in fact, there's I would personally call it a ritual, and a sort of a recounting of the founding father. It's usually a man that was a few generations ago. And once you put together these different founding myths, there's start to be patterns that emerge quite clearly. This founding father used often, well, always from humble beginnings. The story is crafted in a certain way. Sometimes an immigrant working in his little workshop doing who knows what, and then generating this kind of incredible amount of wealth. It's a construction of the family as valuable because of their link through the generations. It's a very particular way of creating and thinking, and that gets repeated and reinforced through various, sometimes literally rituals, where you bring all of the family together, all of the various branches. Sometimes they have songs.
Oh.
Or things that are done. I mean, you can imagine, if you start employing consultants for this kind of thing, you know, the days when you start doing trust building in the workplace, well, scale it up and imagine. And then there's the function of philanthropy, which is crucial because we then sit together and think about our values. If you remember in this one here, I said it a little bit, understand your key concerns, your vision for the future. It's all about thinking about this stuff. And it's almost like, I think Khan articulated it really well, but if you think about the middle class self as being about a person in the present and investing in human capital, different between, you know, the middle class self in the way that Bev Skeggs talks about him or her able to acquire skills and abilities and value because of what he or she does, is very different from this one, because actually you need to learn to toe the line and understand that what matters is the family name. So the behaviors are very different. What is praise is very different. I don't want to sort of descend too much into kind of tabloid thing, but if you think a little bit about what's happening with Meghan and Harry and Kate Middleton, you see, and again, I didn't have time to go into gender, which is an important one, but you see how somebody who has been educated or groomed, or whichever term you want to use, to be someone who knows that her role is to cut ribbons, have children, and be in the background. Because it's the family that needs to continue. You do your duty by the family will stick by you. Yeah, let's not comment on other things. But you need to not come to the fort and speak about your feelings. No one cares. Plus, she was black, so that's very different. But you see, it's about understanding that it's not you who matters, it's the name that needs to continue.
Okay, I have four more people with questions. Five.
Should we take them in
maybe, or try to be a little bit quicker in,
I'll do better.
Asking and answering. You go first.
Hi, thanks, this is really great. I study the global distribution of wealth between countries, and there are so many things that you've said that anecdotally you think you could apply to how a country or a nation thinks about their wealth and their origin stories and why they deserve certain things, and I wonder if there, you know, of anybody writing on that or whether you've considered it yourself.
I can do this one quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I do not, but I would love to.
Yeah. I just think sometimes you... This is all fascinating, by the way. This is really, really, really great stuff. I just think you might be conflating some of the time sort of family attitude, socialization with propaganda from the wealth management industry.
Yeah.
And
okay.
And I just think you need to sharpen that distinction a bit more, because this line here is fantastic, but it's clearly Coote saying, give us your money to, you know, give us business. Because if you don't, you're going to lose everything. And then, you know, I know you're doing work, you were interviewing the families and family members themselves. So I just think making that distinction a bit sharper would make it a lot clearer, you know, which part of this is just marketing and which part of it is actual general, you know, genuine process of socialization in rich families.
Yes, I think that's a very fair point. And as I was explaining earlier about this presentation having been extracted from a much larger thing, where I was going into that quite a lot of depth. And what I found, which was interesting, was how the head of the family would often employ these passive narratives of stewardship and looking after the wealth for the next generations, which as a narrative is very passive. It's like, well, it's just here and I'm taking care of it for the next ones who come along. And that contrasts sharply with the fact that, of course, they manage their advisors and their wealth managers and all of the other people incredibly tightly. It's not like they're not doing that. So, but the presentation always has to be, it seemed to me, I want to look into it a little bit more, but it's almost as if by doing this passive thing, they're kind of absorbing themselves quite a lot of the actual work that goes into reproducing wealth at this rate. So there's almost a split, which I think, even when I was asking questions, was being emphasized about, well, we don't, we just sit here and it grows. And you think, well, no. But thank you, that's a very fair point.
Very quickly, by the way, it's absolutely fascinating, and thank you very much indeed. I didn't know of the institution of a family office. Is it a professionally recognized entity, one? I.e., is there a register, for example,
no.
of family offices?
No.
But they're called family offices in the circles you move in.
Yes.
They're actually called family offices.
Yes, and
okay.
there's an association of family offices.
I see. So if I look it up on the web, I'll find something on it. But two, the paradox that you were referring to, which somebody also has just mentioned, well, clearly a sales ploy on the part of so-called family offices to hire them to protect the wealth of the family. And, you know, whether it says the generational algebra, which you quite rightly pointed out, that's informing the families that unless you hire us, your third generation, 92% of the wealth would have been lost. Sure. Equally, that bar chart you showed, which is going down, which is similar in a sense,
yes,
but that's the cooked up figure by the family offices, isn't it?
Yes and no, because at least five of those were family members themselves. It is not unusual for a family of substantial means to have their own family office. So when you're speaking to an executive, it's a family member themselves. So it is true that my work might end up being blurred, but actually the reality is that it is often blurred. And sometimes when you have the multi-family offices are simply a family that started off doing their own deals and running their own things, another family wants in, and so they become a multi-family office. It might be just two. So actually the ones who have the wealth and their staff, sometimes the line is not so easy to draw between them.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's a fear fear that members of the next generation might opt out of this, might decide not to participate in passing down all that wealth towards the others. And if some of the people you've spoken to were actually contemplating turning their backs on sort of stuff.
Yes, very much so. That's called the issue is the next gens. It's got a name. There are conferences, there are all sorts of things. But yes, it's very much a concern. And that is where philanthropy comes in. Because if the family is concerned, it can, the consultants, and it stands to reason that if you might not want to think about, I don't know, that exploiting that resource that you're exploiting over there to make all the money that you're making, well, we can sit down and think about our values and decide where to invest. And that can bridge that gap during which the children might feel a little bit rebellious. So we build foundations. This guy here, the one at the beginning, at least engaged with my question about inequality. Because normally it would be batted back straight at me by showing me pictures of their own foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So you ask inequality and they give you philanthropy. This one had read it and at least in his mind had an argument that actually this was all a lot of nonsense. But yes, they are concerned. And as far as I can tell, the idea is to use philanthropy. Plus the fact that, again, I strongly think that although in a lot of ways these people are very different, on a human level there's a lot of, if you think about the implications of giving up your money and what it would do to your family as well, you might be willing to give one up, but you also want to lose or make a decision that is so strong that fundamentally says, well, whatever you've done, I reject it. I don't want anything to do with that. It takes actually quite a lot of determination. It's a big loss. You don't just lose the capital, you also lose the family to a large extent. So again, that's why these rituals, these things about keeping the family together, managing the family carefully, because some of them come together and some of them is very important that they never do. So the consultants know perfectly well how to manage it in such a way that is done harmoniously, never for too long, so you don't end up again with a Christmas party that ends up with all the aunts drunk and people saying things that they should never say. It's thought about and it's managed very carefully.
I have some.
Yeah. Just that last comment, Lou, was when you think about the HBO show Succession. I don't know if anybody's seen that.
I haven't. I need
you
to, clearly.
You'll have to see it. But yeah, no, thank you. It was fascinating. I was really interested in this origin story. And the way in which you're mentioning that, often it has this kind of, whether it's real or imagined, kind of upward mobility dimension. I'm doing some work at the moment looking at how people make sense of accepting very large gifts to justify getting on the housing market. And it's interesting that a similar thing is often deployed. And it's particularly, we're looking and sort of probing people on the tension between accepting these gifts and obviously sort of meritocratic notions of earned, you know, of sort of deservingness. And it's often, it seems, that people explain almost in a sense that sort of like their subjectivity is intergenerational, that they're not, that their sense of who they are is seamlessly linked to this, to this previous generation, whereby actually there's a story there that is deserving because it's often this upward mobility story, and that then justifies their windfall because they're actually, who they are is intimately connected to who their parents were and what happened to them. And I just wondered if that was a similar thing to what you were finding here, or what the function the origin story was, and if in any way it sort of acts as a legitimizing force in terms of the potential for these people to feel some tension about this, these inheritances being unearned or, you know, in tension with notions of meritocracy.
Yes, very much so. And I think it links with the previous question entirely. It's about how do you bring in these new generations and you connect them with the founder. In fact, there is, Andy might be able to help here. Isn't there a thing that when you set up a trust, there can be a letter?
A letter of wishes.
Yes.
Discretionary.
Yes. That document is often quoted as being very important.
What's the
if you want, I'm sure you can define it better.
Well, the advantage of a discretionary trust is you don't know who the beneficiaries are until the trustees decide who to make payments to, which is very convenient for tax purposes because it means you don't know who to tax until the money's actually dispersed from the trust. But when the settlor, so the person who sets up the trust, they give the trustees a letter of wishes that says, we want you to make disbursements from the trust in accordance with these principles, which will be like, to our children once they've succeeded at university or something like that.
They actually have to go through hoops to deserve it.
Yeah. Whatever the letter of wishes says. And sometimes it's just a sort of tax avoidance device so that you can't say for sure who the beneficiaries are, even though you basically know who the trustees are going to exercise their discretion in favour of. But I guess also you could say, oh, well, the letter of wishes said we must do this with the money, and so we're just following what the carrying out the settlor's instructions.
Yes. So again, you're establishing this link with the founder. The letter was referred to me in quite a number of conversations about what we're simply carrying out the wishes. So again, you maintain that link. I like what you said. The subjectivity across the generation.
Generational
subject.
That's what we're trying to develop in this paper.
Like that. But yes, that's what it is. And there are various instruments, including the meetings, the coming together, philanthropy, the letters. So you're trying to, if you think about it here, you keep on shifting towards the cultural, the social, and the soft stuff, all the while not looking at what's going on to reproduce this capital at the rates it needs to reproduce and how hard it needs to be invested and what kind of things are you investing in whilst thinking about the pandas somewhere for your philanthropy.
We have time for one more question.
Sorry, maybe just given the importance of philanthropy to the people that you spoke with, did at any point it come up that, like, why do you get to have a philanthropic organization and determine how inequality is dealt with and who gets to disperse at what?
Very rarely was I able to get that. Some people would. These were not easy interviews, but they did all know that I was coming from a place called the International Inequalities Institute. So, and they accepted to be interviewed. So, of course, my sample is not only small, but hugely skewed towards a set of people who would be willing to at least engage with this. Although I might have been introduced by someone who they trusted, nonetheless, they had literally nothing to gain, potentially a lot to lose, and were willing to engage. And normally the standard thing would be presenting me with their foundation or their charity. Sometimes, which again I've heard with my respondents, but in the literature as well, what's referred to is the fact that the state is either inefficient or corrupt.
Mm.
And so therefore it's pointless and I can do much better giving the money directly to the hospital or whatever. So. And sometimes they would have figures at their disposal, which I didn't know if they were true or not, but actually I've heard somebody saying here about leakage of sort of money that you put into the state and how it kind of leaks and never arrives to the correct communities.
Mm.
So that was what was often mentioned.
Okay.
There's a benefit too from setting up a philanthropic organization, namely, although you have to pay out, you get a tax break,
of course,
tax break.
Oh, yes.
So,
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Luna, so much for an interesting talk.